We are back for the second part of our interview with Jeremy Commander and Brian Hank. Welcome, hey. Guys.
Thanks, Zach.
Okay. So we have one more news story that we didn't get to in the other episode. This is one that I found on Gamasutra, which is a video game business website. The title was Five Tips for Surviving as a Stay-at-Home Indie Dev. And now this was sort of geared toward video game developers, but I think this actually affects anyone that is in a stay-at-home worker or even someone that does a second job at home or, like my two guests, has a day job and then is doing their board game design on the side. I'm an indie dev lawyer, and I work from home. I'm actually completely virtual, so I work from wherever I am. So I have the same problems that many indie devs have when they're working at home. And, you know, it's very easy to get lost in your work and forget about the outside world, forget about friends. And so I'm interested. Well, let's go over the 5 points that were in the Gamasutra article. The first one was to go outside every once in a while. I think this is very important. I mean, actually, for me, I like to work at places like Starbucks or Panera Bread, you know, places where you can be outside and it's, you know, it feels like I'm going out and doing something. It's much more exciting. And when I'm actually traveling around the world, I use Regis as a company that has offices in every city. And so I'm actually going to an office, even though I'm working from home, basically. I can work anywhere. So all my business is on my laptop. But I go to an office specifically so that I'm in this environment where there's other people and they're working. It keeps me on task. It keeps me from being too lonely. I can go and get coffee and, you know, chat with people at the, you know, even in other countries. There's always someone to chat with.
It puts your brain in work mode.
It really does.
It gets you away from distractions.
I've been home for the last couple of weeks visiting family, and man, it is very difficult to get started on working. It's extremely difficult. So, you know, going even just out to a Starbucks, you feel like you've left home, and it creates this shift in your mind that now you're in work mode. Do you guys have the same problem?
I'll say that I use the same technique on my days off. If I want to work on board games, I take my laptop and I go to a local pizzeria where they have lots of tables and they don't care if I sit there all day.
Mm-hmm.
And I will sit there and just work on my laptop for hours until the battery dies. Because I find I'm much more productive.
Right.
Even there, I don't have internet, so I have to use my hotspot if I want to look something up. Even without the internet, I'm much more productive in getting things done and not having these distractions than where I'm home, and lots of things can distract me, and I get less done. And I'd say going outside, sunlight in particular. So I have a news scraper. I'm kind of a news junkie, and so I have a little robot that goes and scrapes news for me. And part of that's like productivity tips and studies. And there's been a lot of research on what the effect sunlight has on your brain and your creativity, and a lot of studies on mild exercise or walking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've seen this in multiple studies that, like, taking a walk in the sun for a few minutes is one of the best things you can do to reset your brain, to boost your creativity, and to have more ideas or to solve a problem that you're wrestling with. So rather than sitting there for a long period of time, get up, go outside, take a walk for a few minutes in the sun, and then come back. I personally have experimented with different productivity methods. Are you guys familiar with the Pomodoro technique?
Of course. Yeah.
So not Pomodoro's, me.
Oh, tell me.
Pomodoro is very famous, where the idea is you work for typically a short segment, typically 20 minutes, and then you take a break for 5 minutes, and you work intensely again for 20 minutes. And that's the basics of the Pomodoro technique. And there's lots of software and little apps that will do this for you. If you search for Pomodoro in any app store, you get tons of these. So I tried that. I'm not that ADD. So 20 minutes for me is not productive enough.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been looking at other studies, and a lot of them find that office workers are most productive when they use like a 50-10. So they work intensely for about 50 minutes, and then they take a 10-minute break, and they get up and move. They walk around.
Right.
They talk to someone else. They go to the water cooler. And so now I have a Pomodoro timer on my laptop, and I use that 50-10 to manage my productivity. And I find I get more done doing that, and I solve more problems creatively than just sitting there for hours.
Yeah, I do 45 on and 15 off. And then every 3 or 4, it gives you half an hour. So, I get up from the desk. I walk around. I force myself to get up, walk around, go outside, do something totally different, because, you really need to get your mind off it. I can't stand having it on the desktop screen, so I have it on my phone, sort of off, out of my peripheral vision, but I can feel it vibrate when my 45 minutes is up, so I find that works the best.
There we go. It really works.
That sounds pretty cool. I think the best thing that I do is walking. You know, like mm-hmm. like you mentioned, Jeremy, to get out and walk. I'm a software engineer in my day job, but I've done a lot of remote work. When I moved out to California, I worked for a few months remotely. And I had to do that. I had to just kind of get out and start walking. I also fell in love with the Fitbit. And so, you know, that'll just track your steps and, right. you know, you have goals and it will, you know, help. It has a bunch of different ways to encourage you to walk more. And so, you know, I've run a whole bunch of Fitbit challenges, like at work, jobs, with friends, just to help each other, just to encourage one another to walk more. So we're actually doing one at Gen Con this year. We're doing a big one. We've got a Gen Con event and a ton of people have signed up for it. So it's going to be
That's
great.
Awesome.
Yeah. So it's walking is my best way to stay focused and kind of wake my brain up, like you said, Jeremy.
Right. And not that I'm some paragon of health, but I've heard that walking and small exercise like that, they call it NEAT, non-exercise activity thermogenesis, I think it's called, where it's basically all those small movements compounded during the day is better than just taking 45 minutes to go to the gym at the end of the day. It's better for you. You can avoid things like deep leg thrombosis and other problems that come from sitting all day when you're sedentary like that. Even though you even if you get a workout every day, you're still not getting the health benefits that can come from, you know, taking walks and doing things like that during the day, maybe even stretching at your desk and or exercising in the morning, that kind of stuff. So it's good to focus on that.
And it's good for your dog too.
Yes. Dog. Yeah. That was one of the better things when I lived with a dog, I could walk the dog 5 times a day and that was all my walks, right? It was good. It gets me out in the sun. I think that's great. But my lifestyle now doesn't allow me to have a dog. So unfortunately I don't have that, but.
In a few years, we'll be able to get a robotic dog.
I hope so. It could be a stretch goal in one of our Kickstarters. All right. That's a callback. That's what comedians like myself, funny people, call a callback. Okay. All right. Second point was connecting with the indie community. You know, get on the internet, connect. And I think it's important with board games. In the last part of this episode, we talked about talking to publishers and getting your game designs out there. And I think that's being part of the community is such a huge part of having success in this. If you want to make it a career or a hobby, if you're all alone and you just use the internet, but you're not communicating with a community, it's very difficult to be a part of anything, right? To be a part of the industry, I think. What do you guys think?
Yeah, it's a small community. I mean, right. Especially if you just take tabletop gaming. I mean, there are not that many of us, so go make friends. You know, go on mm-hmm. on Twitter. I've met so many people on Twitter. So yeah, just go anywhere on Board Game Geek or wherever you like to go to talk about board games. Go meet people and build friendships, and then eventually you'll see them somewhere at a convention or something. Everybody wants to talk about board games, so go find people who want to do it and talk.
Jeremy, I would say, so you, yeah, do you have any friends, Jeremy?
You want to get plugged into the community because you'll be a better designer. You'll see more opportunities that you would have missed if you're not plugged in. I met Brian through Twitter, and I met Grant Rodick earlier through Twitter, and he's introduced me to other people too. He's like a prolific Twitter and a bit of a tremendous positive support. And I've connected through lots of people who've been referred into my local game design group through social media online, particularly Twitter. The board game community is very active on Twitter.
Right.
And also, I'll hear about things I wouldn't have heard before. Hey, there's a game design contest over here you can enter. Or is there this Protosfield coming up? Or here's Speed Date at Gen Con and the opportunity to participate in those things. You might miss those if you're not participating in the larger community as a whole. And I would say this is not only online, but participate with the board game community face-to-face in real life. This is a tremendous opportunity that lots of designers miss. They don't go to Protosfield events. They don't go to Unpub events, and those will level you up as a game designer and make you a better designer and forge connections that really come in handy later. Like I have designers who are like, I really like this game. I know a publisher who would be a good fit for this. Let me introduce you. And if I didn't have that face-to-face connection from going to one of these game design events, that wouldn't happen.
Yeah, great. I mean, and if anyone cares, this is one of my big issues with the way I live my life. As a nomad, I'm in other countries where people may not even speak English. So actually doing this podcast is great because I get to talk to other people that are interested in my industry, which I don't usually get to talk about. So this is awesome. And this summer, I'm in the U.S. I'm specifically going to Gen Con and PAX this summer so that I can really meet up. You know, I have most of my clients I've never even met face to face. It's very weird, but I'm very excited to be meeting everyone this summer. So this is very cool. The next point was reaching out on the internet using social media and other ways. We kind of touched on that already. But the one after that is don't forget your friends and your family. I think this is also important. You can't forget the people that are actually around you. It's very easy to get to become very introverted, especially when you're working on a project that takes a lot of time. Do you guys...
Are you saying that board gamers and game designers are introverted? What?
Right. We had to be told to go outside. Let me just, you know, we're basically like basement dwelling Morlocks, I think, for the most part.
But mom, we're like 4 hours into this D&D campaign. Right. We're almost done.
Exactly.
It's really, really tough for some people. I think that's right. What makes this a hobby for a lot of people. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the things you have to, if you want, like, design or publishing or being a part of this industry full time, if you want it to be full time, it's gonna, you know, you'll have to make sacrifices, and the people in your life might have to make sacrifices too. And so they need to be on board with that. And I think that's really important. You know, as a tabletop gaming has taken over a lot of my life, you know, I've had to be, you know, had to have a lot of those, you know, conversations with my girlfriend too, to make sure she's okay with it, you know, just because I don't want what I do to negatively impact her, you know, and she wants to be supportive, but she can only do that to a certain degree. Right. You know, at some point, you know, it's really easy for me to get completely overwhelmed in some project that I'm working on. And sometimes I kind of forget about her and friends and family. And so it's just a conscious thing. You have to just make sure to make time for everybody else, the people who, you know, who really, really matter in your life.
I definitely agree. The last point was to have a schedule. I think this is another important one. There are many days where if I don't have a set schedule, I will sort of dilly-dally until 11 or 12 and then finally say, I need to start getting my day started. But then I end up working till 9 or 10 at night because that's another thing. When you're working remotely or you're working at home, I mean, it's very easy for your work life and your home life to blend. I mean, they're literally blending because you're working at home. So not having a schedule can be dangerous because you can get overwhelmed with the work very easily. Do you guys have a schedule? I know that you have day jobs, but how do you manage your schedules?
Well, my day job is heavily scheduled. It is all scheduled. So I'm very used to that work environment. So on my days off when I work on games, I don't schedule them, but I do have a very significant prioritized to-do list where I say, hey, on this day off, I must accomplish these two tasks. These two things have to be done on that day. And then I have time. Then these are the medium priority tasks and the low priority tasks. And if I don't set those priorities and write it out ahead of time and plan on doing that, then I will spend a lot of time doing low priority tasks that are not that productive, not the important things don't get done. I'm doing some work, but it's not the most important work I should be doing. I've been I'm putting off the hard work or the major tasks that I have to get done now. And so by writing that out, and it is a form of scheduling, then I am more likely to get that done. And then I find if I don't write it all out in advance, then I get less done than when I do. Say, these are the things I'm doing first. That's what I'm going to do in the morning. And then I'm going to focus on these tasks in the afternoon.
And there is nothing more satisfying than crossing things off your list. Or I use Google's little notepad program and, you know, just clicking that little checkbox next to everything. And it grays it out. It's amazing. Brian, do you have some sort of scheduling tips maybe?
Yeah. I'm a scheduler. Yeah. I've worked at companies where, you know, I go into work and I have just meetings back to back the entire day. Mm-hmm. You know, it's, you know, 9 hours straight of meetings. And so I'm used to that. And I like it. And in like Jeremy said, you need to focus on the things, you know, the high priority tasks and don't let the low ones get in your way. I do that. I think the prime example though is Stephen Bonacor of Stronghold Games, who's still working a full-time job as far as I know. But still is, you know, his company is getting bigger and bigger. I think he released like 12 games last year, or in the last year. So like, how do you do that? And I think the key is that he's a project manager. I think somebody mentioned that he's a project manager for his day job. So, he just has his 12 games, you know, that he's, has a project for each one. I'm sure he has, you know, Microsoft project, you know, for each one. And he just knows, how to do it. And he's spent probably, you know, most of his life, learning how to run, how to schedule everything and find the bottlenecks and keep projects moving. And so that's, I'm guessing, a big key to his success.
It's a skill I think we can all learn from. Definitely.
And a key to our callback about talking about publishers versus, you know, going yourself. Mm-hmm. If you get a publisher like that, that's the advantage, that he's going to keep that game on track and on time and not let the stretch goals go crazy. And your game will hit the market. It will go to mass market. And that's the kind of the value the publisher brings.
Absolutely.
Is they may be very good on the project management production side, where the game designer is not so good on that side.
Yep. I mean, they're totally different skill sets, like I mentioned in the last part. And it's good. They complement each other, right? They each can sort of temper each other as well, right? So the design decisions get tempered by the realities of publishing, but the realities of publishing kind of get pushed by, you know, pushing the design and really trying to make something special. So I think it's good. All right. That is the end of our news segment, our broken up news segment. So I have a question here from a user, Steve G, on Board Game Geek. This was actually posted before I started doing the Dice Tower segments, so this is from a year ago. I'm still waiting for some questions from you, the listeners. Please, if you have any legal or business questions about board games or video games, any kind of games, please send them in. So Steve G asked, he wanted to have a segment on the public domain. So people are constantly asking whether or not Cthulhu, for example, is part of the public domain, and the consensus seems to be, well, yes, we think so. Most of Lovecraft's work is anyway, but it doesn't seem like there's a straight answer. It seems like copyright is linked to the author in some way, but estates and corporations can glom onto them and keep them going. So it seems like he didn't really know what the public domain was and how it lasts so long. Or, excuse me, when something goes into the public domain, how copyright lasts so long. So the public domain is basically what happens when copyright protection ends, and now the whole public has those same rights that a copyright holder used to have. So they have the right to distribute it, to create derivative works from it, all those other things. Currently, with the Copyright Act of 76, the life of the author plus 70 years is the term of copyright for something that was created by an individual author. If it's created by a corporation, it's usually 120 years from the date of creation. So it's very long. After that, then things go into the public domain. Before 1978, you know, the periods and the renewals that were required, it's all very different. And I wish Jeremy could look over a public domain table that shows or the copyright, the length of copyright table, because it is extremely unuser friendly going back and, you know, different for a while. Songs that were created or sound recordings created before 1972 didn't have copyright protection, but they had state copyright protection.
Yep.
It's very confusing. So one of the general rules.
Are you saying this is a bunch of Mickey Mouse law?
Well, I don't know. Was it Sonny Bono? I think he's the one we blame. I don't know if it was. Disney is usually the one that catches the blame for, you know, because they have. Look, they've poured
both
a ton
Mickey
of money.
And Donald would have been in the public domain right now.
Right.
Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse had the lobbyists for various media conglomerates not lobbied Congress to change the public domain laws to push them further out into time. And so they're sometimes called Mickey Mouse laws because Disney paid for a lot of those lobbyists. They weren't alone in that. It's like blaming McDonald's for all fast food.
Right.
But they did have a big hand in that, and that's why Mickey and Donald are not in the public domain right now. Can you remind us, Zach, in the Constitution, what was the life of copyright before
it says something for a limited term of years or a limited time. Yes, it does say for a limited time. Hey, it's limited. It's just 120 years.
Now, for patents, didn't they set a set number of years?
20 years for patents, yes.
20 years.
Yes.
So 20 years, and now these laws are up to...
trademark can go on forever. Okay. Look, I didn't create the law. I'm not going to say whether it's right or wrong. I like to deal with reality.
Just, you know,
this is the way things are. So mostly things that were created before 1923 are now in the public domain. And one of the interesting things is Sherlock Holmes is one of the things that was at issue in some recent court cases. basically all but I think 10 Sherlock Holmes novels were done before 1923. So there was sort of a cutoff in what was public domain and what was not. So after a court case, and it was appealed multiple times, and finally it was decided basically anything that was created for Sherlock Holmes prior to 1923 was in the public domain. But things like, I think him having a brother or him getting married, I don't know, there were a few things that came after 1923 that actually you couldn't use. So you could only use the pre-1923 Sherlock Holmes.
No Minecraft for you.
Yes, right, correct.
So what if you mentioned that, so we decided Lovecraft is in the public domain then?
I think Lovecraft came after. I looked this up. Actually, I will recommend back on the Funding the Dream on Kickstarter podcast with Richard Bliss. He did an entire episode about Cthulhu. He had a Cthulhu expert, if such a thing exists, come on the show and explain the whole copyright situation having to do with Lovecraft's works. I think it was he sort of bequeathed them to the public. You know, he wants the public to be able to use them. And that's in that way, they are sort of in the public domain. In the same way that SpaceX's photos are in the public domain, right? They still could be under copyright protection, but they have said to the public, look, you can use these photos. I mean, I use them on my blog all the time because they're free and they're in the public domain. You don't have to attribute them or anything. You can just use their photos, which is awesome. I mean, and there's plenty of people doing that, and there's plenty of people doing things under Creative Commons licenses. So as long as you attribute it, but you know, in the defense of copyright, there, you know, people are putting a lot of money into these things, and I think they should enjoy a certain period of time. And you know, I'm a lawyer, so I guess the longer it is, the better. But not necessarily. I think strong fair use laws are also important.
Sure.
Do you think the life of the author plus 70 years isn't that overdoing it? Isn't the public suffering from not having enough?
Is the this is the crux of the argument, right? Is the public suffering? How is the public suffering? Because you can't use somebody else's copyrighted material. Well, my argument would be, okay, then go make something else. I understand, you know, there's probably at some point there's a limit to things that can be created in an infinite universe. Everything something is going to copy something else, but there are a lot of laws that fight against that, right? There's something called the merger doctrine, where if an idea can only be expressed in one way, then you can't claim copyright protection over it. There's something called cine faire, where if you have a genre or tropes of a genre, like romance movies, if you start to copy elements from another romance movie that are common to the genre, you can't copyright those. Those aren't protectable. So there has to be some sort of creative spark that gives it protection. So there are things going against that. I understand the arguments on both sides. I don't think it's as bad a situation as some, you know, anti-copyright people think. But yes, it could probably be trimmed, and they're working on new copyright laws. It'll probably take another 10 years for that to happen, but hopefully it will be a little more creator focused. But we'll see.
As we move into such a heavy content creation, content consumption age with the internet and digital media, Will we be at a disadvantage in the U.S. where we have these strict copyright laws versus other countries, which may allow more remixing and creativity and have less restrictive copyright laws? Will we suffer in our cultural zeitgeist, what we're able to produce in the future, because our laws are hamstringing our creators versus our competitors in another country that says, well, you can just create whatever you want?
I think there's a fundamental problem with the fact that we've I mean, maybe this is something that's completely unavoidable, but we have broken, I mean, even in the United States, we've broken it up into 50 states, and each state has its own laws and its different ways of looking at things. Copyright is federal, but then you have every country has its own specific laws. Yes, there are treaties, but that also requires you to go into another country and sue someone there, right? Which makes it all the more difficult to actually recover if someone's infringing on your copyrights. All of these things are huge problems, and I don't know how to solve them. I'm just a lowly attorney. I'm not a congressman or a lobbyist or whatever. I think that maybe there's treaties out there now that are being proposed that maybe go in the wrong direction. They try to make things stronger. Is stronger the way to go? I don't know. Again, this is for the legal theorists and other people. I'm just here to analyze the law as it is.
I mean, people like to point out that Disney was built on public domain fairy tales that Disney took and remixed and then copyrighted. Right. Well, now I own Snow White. Well, I made my
again, in their defense, you are free to go and make your own, you know, Snow White and Rose Red or whatever the original Grimm's fairy tales was. You're free to make your own version of that. And many people do. You know, there are plenty of knockoff. I mean, they look like knockoffs, but really Disney was a knockoff as well, right?
Right.
There's plenty of knockoff versions. It's just they're not made with the artistry of Disney. And that's, you know, that's what sets Disney apart. It's not necessarily just taking the Snow White story, but they've done it so iconically that I remember, I think, Princess of Mars. There was the John Carter of Mars, the movie.
Yeah,
but there was
yeah.
also one with Tracy Lords and Antonio Sabato Jr. I saw on Showtime one day. And, you know, they did their own version of it, and that's totally fine. They're... You know, well, one is, well, I mean, both of them bombed, I guess, in their own special ways. But, you know, one of them obviously was higher quality. So it's a question of, it's like with games, right? You know, you can create a game, but if you don't have an audience for it and you don't make a product people want, then nobody's going to care. So you can take that copyrighted material or that public domain material, but if you're not creating something new and interesting with it, nobody's going to care. Well, let me address another issue that has to do with this. So Tarzan is in the public domain. The stories of Tarzan are in the public domain. But
same author as John Carter of Mars.
Right.
Edgar Rice Burroughs.
But
he died in 1950, I believe.
If you go to the USPTO.gov website, you'll see that there are many trademark registrations for Tarzan. So if you were to go out and create a movie called Tarzan, you would run into some problems, not because of copyright, but because of trademark. They trademark protects something different. So it's protecting the fact that they want consumers, when they see a product that says Tarzan, to know that it's coming from the Edward Rice Burroughs Foundation or estate, not from Joe Schmo that's making his own Tarzan movie. And I just think it's important for creators to realize that there isn't just copyright. Public domain isn't the end of your analysis, right? There are other things that you need to look at. You know, has another company been using that as their trademark? Generally, you can't copyright a word like Tarzan or a small phrase or something like that. It's the bigger picture, the bigger creative work, right? But you can trademark small phrases like that as long as they are connected with these goods. So it's just something to watch out for. I would recommend anyone who wants to use public domain materials, get copyright and trademark clearance from an attorney before you go ahead with that. Because if you butt up against the Edgar Rice Burroughs estate, you know, you're going to end up with a cease and desist letter and then probably a lawsuit after that.
Well, author plus 70 years will mean 2020, 5 years from now. It'll be 70 years from his death, and you may be in the clear if you can wait another 5 years.
Okay. Oh, so wait, it wasn't – all right. Then I was mistaken by saying that it was in the public domain. Was I?
Well,
there may have been Tarzan.
Tarzan was published earlier, right? And he's before the dividing line, right?
Okay.
But some of the Tarzan stories were published much later.
Right. So it so runs I into the Sherlock Holmes problem.
Sherlock Holmes.
Right.
Yeah, you're gonna
right.
have that mixed mm-hmm. mixed bag there. Right. I loved the John Carter world. Mm-hmm. I'd love to do something there, but the same thing. The stories on that one I think were published all the way up to 1942.
Right.
And so then they're kind of that mixed domain as well.
Imagine
if I did Tarzan with like a colon and then like a subtitle, could I get away with that, or would I be in trouble then?
I think you would have to run through an analysis of how likely it is to confuse consumers. So
yeah,
there's nine factors, and you have to go through that. Hire a lawyer. Have him look at
that.
It, right? You don't have to hire me. I'm just saying, just hire someone. That's all I'm saying. Brian, did you have a question about this?
Yeah, let me ask you a question about something that I think tabletop game designers may run into. Have in the past. We actually had something similar with Booze Barons, but a lot of times games will be created on something in the real world.
Right.
So something like in Booze Barons, we have locations, which are, you know, like speakeasies for this Prohibition city in which the game is based.
Right.
So we might have a restaurant name, or, you know, we could take one from the 1920s, like the Cotton Club is a popular speakeasy from back then. You know, like I'm kind of wondering, like, can I use that as my as a location in the game, or do I need to do more of a kind of a knockoff location like the Curtain Club,
right?
Or something like a game about fast food, and, you know, can I have Subway in my, you know, in my game? You know, I know the answer to that, but I guess just for conversation's sake, can I do that, or is something similar?
Sure, that's a good question, and luckily there have been some court cases that answer this question exactly. So, well, let me start. Let's unpack it a little bit. First thing is, so this sort of falls under the First Amendment, protecting expressive speech. The Supreme Court had there was a case in the Supreme Court in 2011, Brown versus, I forget the name of the case, but basically they said that video games, like movies and like plays and like books, are all protected. You know, they're used to communicate ideas and plots and characters and all these creative things. That's expressive speech that is protected by the First Amendment. So with that comes a lot of other things, like fair use of trademarks and things like that. Now, it's not been settled that a board game is also falling under that case, because a video game, actually, I think it's interactive. It usually tells more stories, you know, and does a game like Pong also qualify for First Amendment protection? That's sort of questionable. So I don't think video games as a whole are, you can say with a blanket statement, yes, they're all protected by the First Amendment. You can't say that about games either. But for argument's sake, let's say that board games, especially something like a game that's, you know, has some expression in it and artistic expression. So let's say that you are protected by the First Amendment. So under that rule, there's a case called Rogers versus Grimaldi, and that was one that it covered the use of trademarks, third-party trademarks, in an artistic work. And because the First Amendment protects them, they look at two things. So they look at whether the third-party trademark is there artistic relevance to using that third-party trademark. So if you're using in the speakeasy game, not that I'm giving you legal advice, disregard this as legal advice. If you're using that third-party trademark in your game, is there artistic relevance? Well, in your case, you know, you have you're trying to create this this world of the speakeasies and Prohibition era. So yes, absolutely, there's artistic relevance. And actually, in one of the seminal cases on this that had to do with one of the Grand Theft Auto games, the court in the Ninth Circuit said basically anything more than zero will pass that test of artistic relevance. It's just a little bit. You just need a little bit. Same with getting copyright protection. If you just
what was
have
the thing in Grand Theft Auto that was in the case?
It was the Pig Pen Gentleman's Club in San Andreas, and I think there's a real strip club called the Playpen. So they sued. They sued Rockstar, and Rockstar won because the logo was very similar, the building was very similar, everything. You know, I think the artist there, it came out in the court, you know, they had gone and photographed the actual building, and they used that to create this parody, right? So is there artistic relevance? Yes. And, you know, it's anything more than zero. And so the second prong is, are they deliberately misleading you as to the source or the content of the work? So the trademark is protecting the connection between the consumer and the source of the work. So would someone think that the Cotton Club, I keep using your real world example, please disregard, this is not legal advice. You know, is the Playpen or the Pigpen Gentleman's Club, is that misleading the customer that it's somehow using the trademark because it's related to the Playpen strip club? Probably not. You know, it's obviously a parody. It depends, and it's a case by case basis, obviously. So the first prong is usually met, but the second one is where you might get tripped up depending on how you're using it, right? If you're putting it on the box as the title of the game, right, that's going to look like, you know, that's going to look like they're supporting it. Whereas if it's just one of the cards or something like that, it's a lot less. And, you know, there's other things you can do, like putting a disclaimer, you know, we're not connected with the Playpen strip club at all or whatever when you do your strip club game.
Does the fact that something may, let's say this is a business that's been around for a very long time or is historical. So in this case, we're using an historical example.
Right.
During Prohibition 80 years ago, this was significant. Maybe there's still a Cotton Club today. Maybe not.
Right.
I don't know. Maybe someone still owns that trademark and perpetuating, you know, with the intent to reopen it. If game designers love to do games about history and different historical periods, is the fact that this is something relevant to history way in the past going to help me using this, or does it not matter?
Well, I mean, that's going to speak to the first prong, right? That's going to speak to, you know, is there artistic relevance to this? And yes, probably. You know, you're creating an artistic work here when you create this board game. As long as it's not dead simple and there is some artistic expression to it, you're probably going to be able to meet that prong, whether it's historically significant or not. And if it is, that just goes even further to your case, I would think.
Sure.
Again,
how about
when you try to kind of go go close to these kind of gray areas, mm-hmm. You know, the more risk you're adding to somebody possibly filing a lawsuit against you too. So, right. You know, is it really worth it to make this game? You know, do you really need that? You know, something so similar to something that already exists, you know, is it worth it to get close to that gray area? Maybe not.
I mean, I generally will advise clients, look, there's always a risk, even if you're very far away or if the case is 100%. Well, it's never 100%, but if it's strongly in your direction, someone could always sue you, right? And you may end up having to defend that either in court or just shutting yourself down because you can't afford that, right? Yep. If your margin is very slim on the game, you don't have the money to even hire a lawyer to respond to the cease and desist letter, maybe. So, you know, do you want to even... Or wake the dragon, I guess. Maybe not. I don't know.
Yeah, if you want to win a lawsuit, just sue a board game company because they probably won't be able to defend themselves.
Right. Yeah.
So then I have another question.
Sure.
How about using famous places and or landmarks?
Sure.
So, like, if I use the Eiffel Tower in my game as a piece or a component, I could probably get away with that. Well, let's say I use the Freedom Tower that's just been built in New York. Can I have that in my game, or is that like a protected work, that the outline or the shape and the name of that building?
Right, and there is copyright protection for architectural works. But again, this is where there's always this, you know, the copyright statute versus the First Amendment, right? They are always butting heads, and so this is where there may be a fair use question, or there may just be no copyright protection in that, depending on how form versus function, right? Functional things generally don't get copyright protection, but if it's the artistic form of it, then there could be protection in it. So, and there could be a trademark in it, maybe. If they're using it as a brand identifier, then they could have trademark rights in that. And so then you would have to do your First Amendment analysis generally to see if you can meet that or not.
All right. Yeah. I have someone I know, a game designer, that was putting different landmarks in their game from places over the world. So there was like the Eiffel Tower and the Statue of Liberty and the Golden Gate Bridge. And they wanted to, you know, be a pretty diverse around the world. And so for South America, I suggested they use the Christ the Redeemer statue, which is very famous and you see all the time.
Right.
And they wound up not using it because there was some sort of trademark protection for that statue, and they couldn't even use it in their board game amongst all these other landmarks.
Right.
And I was like, oh, that's a huge bummer.
How did they know they couldn't use it? Not that I want to comment on their specific case, but
I don't know what level of legal advice they got.
Right.
They looked into it, and apparently there's been some cases in the past
with
that. You know, that's something that you can't just use. You have to like license that.
Sure. Yeah.
And so they were like, oh, I just want to deal with that, so I'm going to skip it.
Well, sometimes
they want using like the giant stone heads from Easter Island or something instead.
Right. Well, you'll notice in a lot of TV shows, they'll either blur. I've seen like the Mercedes symbol taken off of cars. I've seen things blurred out. T-shirts are blurred out, things like that. You see that a lot. And even if it would be okay, they're doing it just to avoid having any problem in the first place. Maybe they have a fake Coke can that sort of looks like Coke, but isn't. They're doing that to avoid the possibility of a lawsuit because they're usually not using it in a trademark way. They're not identifying the brand, them as the source of this brand.
Right. The bad guys drive the Mercedes as the getaway car.
Right. So maybe they're tarnishing that trademark. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, arguments can always be made and people can always be sued whether they're right or not. Right. So they're trying to stave that off in the beginning by not even bothering with it, I think. So, game developers may take a lesson from that and just try not to piss anybody off in the first place. Ooh, did that make this explicit? All right, I should beep that out. Anyway, so Jeremy, can you tell us where to find you and what you're working on that we can check out?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Jeremy Norcal. My website is boardgamebuilders.com. I'm on the Forbidden Limb podcast at theforbiddenlimb.com.
Well, our listeners will definitely check that out. Brian, where can we find you, and what do you have going on?
Well, you can find me on any social media platform, pretty much. Just search for Overworld Games, and you'll find me. Or The Forbidden Limb, our podcast. So, best way to find us, we've got New Salem coming out at Gen Con this year.
Woo!
Bombers and Traitors expansion to Good Cop, Bad Cop is also debuting at Gen Con. And then, of course, Booze Barons launching on Kickstarter August 29th with design by the famous Jeremy Commander.
Awesome. This is a message from Zach. We'll be back next week with a third part of my conversation with Brian and Jeremy. In the meantime, you can check out the new site that I've just launched, IndieGenerator.com. It's a site where board game and indie game developers can generate contracts for less than the cost of hiring a lawyer like me. I've got two contracts up there right now, a work-for-hire agreement and a partnership agreement, with more coming over the next few weeks. Also, as a special deal for listeners of this show, I've got a coupon code that gets you 75% off of your contracts until the end of July. Just enter the code IndieGenLaunch to get the big discount. IndieGenLaunch. Otherwise, you can check me out at GameLawyerBlog.com and AlawyerAbroad.com. I'll see you next week.